the fight against COVID-19 is going on today in clinics and hospitals and testing sites, but that fight began in a clinical lab.
The laboratory that does this testing didn't used to work day and night. They do now.
Today on the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a microbiologist from the Mayo Clinic about how the coronavirus was identified and how tests are being developed. We'll also spend an academic minute with the origin story of U.S. healthcare. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is the Best of Our Knowledge. Last December, a cluster of atypical pneumonia patients was detected in Wuhan, China. That seems like an eternity ago. After much research and testing, scientists determined that those patients were infected by a virus similar to the one that caused the SARS outbreak in 2003. But according to the World Health Organization, a total of just over 8,000 people worldwide became sick with SARS during that outbreak, and 774 died. The U.S. had only 29 confirmed cases and no deaths from SARS. Things are very different with the current COVID-19 outbreak. To learn just how different, we spoke with Dr. Bobby Pritt, a clinical microbiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She is part of Mayo's COVID-19 response team. I asked her how scientists discovered that this was a brand new virus and how those first tests were developed.
Well, we've had a number of times throughout our history, recent history, where something new like this pops up. And we have a number of tools in our arsenal that we can go and try to help us figure out what this is. So in this case, they were able to grow the virus and do molecular testing on it. And that's how we figured out it was a brand new virus that no one had known about before. And then the molecular virologists, the people who study virology and viruses, got together and realized it was very, very similar to the virus that caused SARS back in 2003. SARS is named severe acute respiratory syndrome. So SARS virus that we knew about back then is a close cousin of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that's currently circulating.
And this may be a little inside baseball, but what's the difference between a coronavirus and a virus?
Well, a virus is a small particle that can self-assemble. It actually isn't really alive. It's kind of like a self-assembling machine, which is a little scary because it can enter your cells and do all these things, and yet it technically isn't alive. So there's tons of different viruses. We have viruses that cause the common cold. We have viruses that cause gastrointestinal distress and diarrhea, things like norovirus. So all sorts of different viruses that infect animals and humans and plants, you name it. So then let's talk about viruses that infect humans. Well, respiratory viruses in particular, we all know about them. The common cold is caused by things like rhinovirus, but it could also be caused by coronavirus. But those are the mild circulating viruses that have been with us for decades. So we are now dealing with a brand new coronavirus. And I think that's why people got confused early on, because they said, well, we know coronavirus. Coronavirus causes the common cold. Why do we care about this? But this is a brand new coronavirus. And really, when you dissect it out, there are different families of coronaviruses. This one is a beta coronavirus that falls into that more severe category because they all come from animals. So that means we've never been exposed to them before.
And how do you go about developing a test for something like this?
Well, first you need to have scientists take a good look at the virus, do some molecular testing, and be able to uncode or decode its entire genetic material so that we know all the little pieces that make up its genes. And in this case, it's an RNA virus, so we need to know all the pieces of that RNA, its whole genome. So scientists did that early on, and thankfully, in this day of readily sharing across the internet, they posted this online. So everyone had access to it. That was great. So then it's just a matter of looking at the different parts of the coronavirus and looking at its RNA and knowing what we know about viruses already, figure out what would be a good region that we would want to detect in a test. So you wouldn't want to detect something that's prone to mutations and it's going to change rapidly over time. Instead, you want to develop a test against a part of the viral RNA that's not going to change, something like its key core structures. And that's what people tend to be picking for designing a test. So what kind of tests are out there? Well, most of the tests are looking at detecting a piece, a small piece, of the virus's RNA genetic code using amplification process, where you amplify the RNA until it gets to a point that there's so much of it present that you can easily detect it. And that's called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. So that's what most of the tests are that we're all working with these days.
And something like this, is this done by private labs, by public labs? How is the workload put around?
In the United States, the CDC is usually the first to come up with a test. That's just because of who they are. They're going to have early access to patient specimens, and they're going to be able to work with foreign governments and get a hold of actual viral specimens so that they can develop a test early on. It's their job to then ramp up testing at the CDC and distribute those testing packets, when appropriate, to state health labs. Well, that's great for the state and the public health lab, but that doesn't help the laboratories that are on the front line, where they're at clinics like where I'm at at Mayo Clinic, and we're seeing patients directly. We can't send all of our specimens to the Minnesota Department of Health. They, quite frankly, don't have the capacity to do that type of high-volume testing. So that's when you get into the role of private clinics, and in this case, many private clinics also developed their own tests. Now, you're talking high-complexity laboratories here, tests that are used to being able to do this sort of thing, where they're developing tests for other pathogens all the time, year-round. So they have the skills and expertise. They know what goes into developing a new test. So at Mayo Clinic, we have decades and decades of experience of developing our own tests. It's something we do every day. So early in February, we decided, okay, this COVID-19 pandemic is really sweeping across the country. We need to have our own test. So at that point, we put together a team led by my colleague, Dr. Matt Binegar. He assembled 15 people in our lab, development technologists, and they essentially worked around the clock to develop a test. It took them about 3 weeks, which is really unprecedented. Usually you're talking 3 months or even 6 months to develop and bring a new test live and have it implemented. So in 3 weeks, they had developed the whole test, done all the studies they needed to show it was a good and accurate test, and had it up and running, which was just amazing. Now, the third component we didn't mention is the commercial labs. We have commercial companies like Roche and Abbott and Cepheid, and they're used to developing tests too, and they send them through the FDA and they get approval, and then other laboratories buy them and use them. So they're not making a test just for themselves to use like Mayo Clinic did, but they're developing tests as a commercial company and then they want to sell them to other labs. So shortly after we developed our own test, we started seeing these commercial kits coming out. And that's really important because I think we're learning in this whole outbreak that no one group can do it all. Mayo Clinic, we're now at about 5,000 tests a day. But if you look at the population of the United States, that wouldn't begin to touch what we would actually need for testing capability. So we need the commercial, the public health, and the private clinics all working together developing tests.
Well, you mentioned something there that I wanted to touch on again. You said the word kit, testing kits. Are there actual kits, or is that just something you call it?
It is a kit. That's how we refer to it. But the definition of a kit is going to differ depending on who is making it. So the CDC, when they make their PCR, I should say we all have the same components. Some are just packaged prettier when they package it up in Roche because they put it in a nice box with their logo and all the, you know, things have color-coded tubes and caps. When the CDC is making it, they're probably making it with standard tubes and putting more of a, you know, machine-generated label on it, and then they're sending it out to the state health labs. In my lab at Mayo Clinic, because it's a laboratory-developed test, we're ordering some of the components for this kit, we would call it, from all different companies, and then we're putting it together, and we are responsible for the quality of each of those components. So we don't really tend to call our product a kit, but in general, it's a common way to refer to the whole product, all that comes together to make a PCR test.
So when you do these tests, take us through the process from the initial swabbing to actually getting the results. What happens and how long does that take?
Yeah, well, sure. Let's start with getting the swab. So first you have a patient who doesn't feel well or presumably has some reason for being tested. Most places in the U.S. have some sort of screening process because we just don't have enough tests at this point to go around. So the focus is really on the patients that are at risk for severe disease, the people who are in the hospital, and our healthcare workers who are not feeling well and they're on the front line seeing patients. So these are all people you really, really need to know if they have COVID-19 or not. At Mayo Clinic, we have a screening triage, a nurse triage line. It's going to be different at different clinics around the country. But usually there's some sort of screening process. So at Mayo Clinic, they will call a screening health line and answer a series of questions, and then they will find out whether or not they're eligible for testing. And clearly, if someone's really sick, you don't want them to come in necessarily to go get their nose swab. They might need to go to the emergency room directly. So that's another reason why you need a triage. You need to get the people who really need testing, the people who are super sick, you need to make sure they get care, and the people that don't really need testing, you need to tell them they have to wait and maybe stay at home and get better and make sure they don't have worse symptoms over time. So they go through that triage system, and let's say you have a patient then who calls and they're told to go in and get swabbed. Again, people do this differently. Some people are actually having them go to their local emergency room or a clinic. Many places, though, are setting up drive-through clinics, which are really slick. We are doing these at Mayo Clinic where the person drives up either by themselves if they can or with, you know, a friend or a loved one who drives them up, and then they roll the window down. There's a healthcare worker who has their medical record number and all the information because they called ahead, and they have the swab and they collect a swab from the patient while they're sitting in the car. So it's as minimal risk as we can get it for the healthcare worker who is really on the front line here. The healthcare worker will have appropriate protective, personal protective equipment, or PPE. So they'll probably have a mask or a respirator, eye goggles, a fluid face shield, a gown, gloves, shoe covers. It's going to depend a little bit locally as to what's available. So then they stick a swab through the window and collect it while the person's sitting in their car. The preferred specimen is a nasopharyngeal swab. And Bob, I don't know if you've ever seen or had a nasopharyngeal swab. It's not very comfortable.
From personal experience, I would not recommend it.
Yeah, I've had one too. Wouldn't recommend it, but it is the best way to get a specimen for COVID-19. It goes into your nose, but then it goes several inches back, all the way back to basically the base of your tongue, sort of parallel to where the base of your tongue would be. So that would be a preferred specimen, but the CDC has also said because of shortages of those swabs, you could also collect a specimen from the nose or the throat. So we take that specimen, you put it into a tube that has liquid that allows the specimen to stay stable if there's virus present, and then you cap it up, put the patient's label on it. There should be at least two patient identifiers, usually patient's name and medical record number, date of birth, that sort of thing. It goes to the lab for testing. Now, in the laboratory, to do PCR, it's actually reverse transcription PCR. Because you're starting from viral RNA, you need to turn that into a DNA copy, and then you amplify that. Most tests use an upfront process to isolate and purify the viral RNA that may be present in the patient's specimen. The viral RNA, if present, is turned into DNA, and then it's copied over and over and over and over. So you end up with millions of copies of the viral RNA. And when you're doing real-time PCR, there are little fluorescent probes in the mix that will bind to the virus as it's amplified at certain points. So you get more and more fluorescent signal, and the instrument can read that signal. And when the signal gets bright enough, the instrument can actually identify that that patient has a virus in their specimen. And then that generates a result. Thank you.
Still to come, our conversation with the Mayo Clinic's Dr. Bobby Pritt continues as we talk about turnaround times for testing and lessons learned for the future. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. And now let's continue listening to our conversation with Dr. Bobby Pritt. Dr. Pritt's a clinical microbiologist and part of the COVID-19 response team at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Now, in a place like Mayo Clinic, I'm sure the results go from patient to lab back to patient rather quickly.
Yes. Yeah, we are running this now for 3 shifts. The laboratory that does this testing didn't used to work day and night. They do now. So we work all day, all evening, and then all night. So we crank out as many of these as we can. We even have a separate laboratory who's also doing additional testing. So like I said, right now we're at about 5,000 specimens within a 24-hour period. Our turnaround time, we say that we want to be around 24 hours. We're actually significantly less than that. It's probably more like 10 hours or even less by the time the specimen reaches our lab. But other labs, I think, are struggling with longer turnaround time. Some of the large reference labs, they're more at a 3, 4, even 5-day turnaround time. That's why everyone's getting so excited now about these rapid PCR tests that can be done in anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes. Those are great. Those are commercial products made by companies like Abbott and Cepheid. And those are available in very, very limited quantities. But those are tests that even could be done in a doctor's office at a point-of-care setting.
I'm sure those tests are a bit more expensive, though, right?
They are definitely more expensive. And also, the companies can only make them so quickly. You know, Bob, we talked about all of those steps of the process if you're going to get a swab and get tested. Well, everything in that whole process is really facing severe supply demands. So everything from the personal protective equipment that the healthcare workers are wearing, you've probably heard nationwide about the shortages of masks, gloves, gowns, face shields, but then those swabs that you collect the specimen, those are in limited supply, which is why the CDC is now saying it's okay to just collect a specimen from the front of the nose or from the throat. That may not be as good, but it's, you know, you make do when you have to. And then interestingly, even the liquid that the swab is placed into had become in short supply. And so the CDC, the FDA, and Mayo Clinic actually helped in this process by validating different types of transport media. Turns out that saline, phosphate buffered saline, is actually a good substitute. And saline isn't a lot more readily available than some of these more expensive viral transport media. But then the tests themselves, those are in short supply. The companies just can't make them fast enough. And when they do make them, they're getting prioritized for the really hard hit areas, like in New York City and Washington State and New Orleans. So even if you have an instrument in which you could perform a test, it doesn't mean that you're even going to get the test kit. Even if you had enough swabs and viral transport media and gowns and masks and all of that, the rate limiting step still might be the tests themselves. So we're ramping up. People are putting a lot of time and effort into this. The federal government's been involved. But there's a lot of places, I think, that are struggling, and then they're sending out their tests and they're waiting a week to get results. And that's really tough.
When developing a test in the lab, does some of that work inform the treatment later on? Can you see something and, oh, I know how to fight this thing?
Well, certainly just knowing if it's positive or negative is going to inform the treatment. But another avenue we didn't even get into is a second type of test, which is detecting the antibodies that a person and their immune system develops to a virus. So what we've been talking about up to this point is just detecting the RNA of the virus itself. And if you detect viral RNA in a person's specimen, you assume that they either have the infection right now or they just very shortly got over it, but that they had it really recently. But then within a period of a week or two, the body's immune system really starts kicking in and develops antibodies. That's part of their immune response. They're protective and they help fight against the virus. It takes about 8 days for those antibodies to get to a level where they're really detectable. We could do a second type of test called serology, where we could actually detect the antibodies. So getting into that whole question of, can a lab test help inform treatment decisions? Well, there's a test where if you could detect antibodies, then you can say, okay, this person was infected, and at that point, you know if they're better or not, and then possibly at that point, if they no longer have symptoms, you could say they had the virus, they recovered, and you could start thinking about how to make decisions of sending them back to work. There's even some talk about having those patients, if they were willing, donate some of their serum with their protective antibodies in it and potentially giving that to people who are really sick for that other person to help fight their infection.
Do we know if for this particular disease that there is immunity after recovery?
There does appear to be immunity, and there's been some studies in animals showing that the immunity that is formed does seem to be protective, and it doesn't look like people get infected again once they have this. So we don't know how long that protective immunity lasts, but from what we can tell, there's some promising data out there showing that those antibodies could protect you from getting infected again and could even be shared with another person and maybe help protect that person.
How are we going to know when this is all peaked? Will we just know until we start seeing the number of cases going down?
I think so, Bob. I think what we're seeing in China, you know, and looking now, we don't know if they're really going down, but it looks like they are. I think they still have some cases from the reports I've heard, but I think our goal is to hit that state where we feel like we've hit our peak and now cases are reliably, consistently going down.
I guess the only other thing I had written down here are the hot spots around the country where there seems to be a lot of cases. Are those just the places where there seem to be enough tests?
Well, yes and no. So we certainly know about the hot spots where there are tests and people are getting sick and there's media and there's good public health response, good government, good reporting. But I do worry about our resource-limited settings where people are living in poverty. There's not good government and healthcare infrastructure. Places like sub-Saharan Africa, parts of Latin America, there are probably cases there that are just not getting reported because they don't have tests, but yet they probably have a lot of spread. Could be that maybe a lot of patients are asymptomatic. People that are symptomatic might not be getting to their physician to get tested. There may not be a physician nearby or a healthcare clinic. So I think we're really going to have to keep an eye on some of these sites worldwide because to them, disease could be devastating. It's challenging for us all.
What are we learning through all this? Are we taking a look at the way this is rapidly increasing and saying, you know what, the next time we can do it this way?
Yes. The good news is we are learning a lot in the United States, worldwide as well. But in the U.S., I think that we learned a lot about the role that the government would play in an outbreak, the importance of having adequate support of our government branches like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, having them with the power and the resources to be able to make decisions rapidly. The same thing with the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. I think we've also learned that some of the extent of the regulation that's in place can be quite challenging and perhaps counterintuitive when it comes to trying to quickly get testing out to everyone, but then putting a lot of administrative hurdles in place. We've seen the FDA start off with a lot of requirements for labs bringing up their own tests, and one by one, the FDA's backed off on almost all of those, trying to just really make it as easy as possible for bringing up tests. But initially, there was a lot of concern that trying to bring up a new test was going to take weeks and weeks of time that was really unnecessary. So I think once this is all over, my hope is that government and the clinical lab community will come together and have some discussions about how this could be done better next time.
Dr. Bobbi Pritt is a clinical microbiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She is director of the Clinical Parasitology Laboratory in Mayo's Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology. Dr. Pritt also has a blog called Creepy, Dreadful, Wonderful Parasites, and we'll link to that at wamc.org. So how did the American healthcare system become the slightly dysfunctional hodgepodge that we have today? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Public hospitals used to be a safety net for healthcare. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Simon Hayter, assistant professor of public policy at Penn State University, details why this changed.
The role of government in the U.S. healthcare system has been contentious long before the recent emergence of Medicare for All proposals. Nonetheless, the U.S. could have potentially ended up with a British-style, government-run healthcare system. But the country went a different route. What happened? My recent research seeks to answer this question by looking at the interaction between public insurance programs and hospitals run by local governments. Focusing on California, I show that governments have always been extensively involved in healthcare. Indeed, their involvement grew steadily until the 1960s. Yet in 1965, a dramatic shift occurred, the enactment of Medicaid and Medicare. In a story of unintended consequences, the programs largely shifted the responsibility for the needy and sick to state and federal governments. The results have been stunning. While California's network of county hospitals reached near universal proportions in the early 1960s, all but the most well-resourced local governments in turn began closing their hospitals. Undoing the nation's safety net of public hospitals has had crucial implications for the nation's health. Public hospitals have disproportionately shouldered key roles that private providers often seek to avoid. Moreover, public hospitals have served as a backstop for the poorest members of society. Indeed, eligibility restrictions on programs like Medicaid in many states virtually excluded all adults, no matter how poor, let alone immigrants. Crucially, these developments have changed healthcare politics by taking questions of healthcare access off local agendas. Advocates for any large-scale health reform efforts should be mindful of the eventual unintended side effects.
That was Simon Hayter of Penn State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org. ¶¶